Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, January 2nd, 2014. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, Chris Colby of BeerAndWineJournal.com joins us to talk about brewing barley wines. Barley wines are the subject of an extensive series of articles that Chris has posted on Beer and Wine Journal. If you're new to home brewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, BasicBrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. You can follow me on Twitter. My username is BasicBrewing, all one word. Also, you can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing.james, and our show page on Facebook is at facebook.com/basicbrewing. We're on Google Plus, too, and thanks again to everybody clicking on the Amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site. You apparently know how it works because you wore that sucker out over the holiday season. We're extremely grateful for that. Whenever you think of shopping at Amazon, go to our website first, basicbrewing.com. Click on our link. That will take you back to Amazon. You can shop, not spend any extra, and help to support this show. We also have associate links for Brew Your Own magazine and the American Homebrewers Association on the site that work in similar fashion as well. You can find our Basic Brewing iPhone app on iTunes and our Android app on Amazon.com. We're on the BlackBerry podcast directory, and we're on the Stitcher app, and we're on the Windows Phone directory, too. Check out our Brewer's Logbook at BasicBrewingShop.com. In the front is a blank calendar that you can use to track your fermentations and plan your brews, something that you'll need for this brand new year. And there is room in the back to log the details of up to 50 batches of brew. If you want to put a tip in our tip jar, some coinage in our guitar case, you can go to BasicBrewing.com/support. And thanks to everybody who's done so already. Protect your precious beer with one of our growler bags. Check those out at BasicBrewingShop.com. There is a new Basic Brewing video episode out there. It is coincidentally our end-of-the-year barley wine episode. In this episode, Steve and I revisit a barley wine from years past, a fruitcake barley wine. I scaled it up from a 1 gallon to a 2 gallon batch this year. And yes, I know the date on the intro says January 31st, 2013, instead of December 31st. I would blame my proofer, but I obviously don't have one. I'm recording this on New Year's Day, and I spent the last evening of 2013 in a bittersweet way. Unless a New Year's miracle happens, it will likely be the last night for Tanglewood Branch Brewing Company. You've heard about Tanglewood on this show, and you've heard the owner, J.T. Wampler, talk about his brew pub. It has been a wonderful place. Warm atmosphere, good food, tasty beers. But for all the things that were right about the place, it apparently didn't come together financially. If you've been watching my Twitter feed and our Facebook page, you've seen that there's a crowdfunding effort to help save the pub, and there is some time left in that. Andy Sparks was there last night as well, and Jack McAuliffe was in attendance, as he usually has been at Tanglewood. And Jack made homemade eggnog, and he was also serving up homemade pickled eggs, and both of those were awesome. But I don't know what to say other than good luck to J.T. Wampler and his crew. I hope that Tanglewood can either survive somehow or find life somewhere else. Womp did so many things right. It's a shame that if it were to go away. So good luck to everybody. We will keep you posted. Now let's go on to more happy things. Our conversation with Chris Colby of BeerAndWineJournal.com on brewing big barley wines. Chris Colby, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Hey, James. Thanks for having me. And Happy New Year's.
Happy New Year to you as well. We're going to talk about something that we have talked about before, but it's been years and years and years. So it's time to address it again. And you did a series about this on BeerAndWineJournal.com. A 10-part series, 11-part series, including recipes and all that?
It was multi-part. I think there's maybe 6 articles, although some of them had 2 parts, so yeah.
It's a bunch of stuff.
it's a It's a whole bunch of stuff up there.
And good stuff. And we're talking about barley wines, big beers, but not all big beers are barley wines. Is that right?
Right. Barley wine is a type of ale that's typically strong and sort of built on a built roughly in the model of a pale ale. You know, it's usually lots of pale malt, a little bit of crystal, and that's it. You know, and other big beers, of course, you know, there are big stouts, there are big porters, there are big, you know, all different kinds of ales, and there's also strong lagers. But yeah, barley wine's a style of beer, not just a strength of beer.
So a triple, Belgian triple, would technically not be a barley wine?
Right. Yeah, a Belgian triple would be a Belgian triple.
an Imperial India Pale Ale or a double IPA, not a barley wine.
Yeah, that's an interesting case because both barley wines and double IPAs are sort of based on pale ales. They're bigger versions of pale ales. But one thing I do in the article is when appropriate, when there's a difference between a double IPA and a barley wine, because they're both big, hoppy, you know, sort of pale or amberish ales, draw the distinctions between them. And the biggest one is that barley wines are much more fuller in body than a double IPA. In a double IPA, it's a big, hoppy, strong ale, but the body of the beer is fairly dry. At least it's comparatively dry given the strength of the beer, and that helps the hops just shine through. You know, because as a double A or double IPA is mainly, you know, a hop assault.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas a barley wine is a more balanced beer, it starts at a high gravity, you know, at least as high, if not higher, than a double IPA. But it doesn't, given the recipe and the way you make the wort, you know, especially your the mash regime, you don't shoot for a highly fermentable wort, so you get a beer that stops at a fairly high finishing gravity, leaving a fair amount of body and then sweetness to balance all the hops in the beer. Because barley wines are very hoppy, like a double IPA. It's just they're geared more towards balance than towards just, you know, full-on presentation of hops only.
Yeah, there are tricks that you use in a double IPA to dry the beer out, using sugar as an adjunct for one thing, you know, maybe mashing at a lower temperature to dry the beer out a bit so that those hops come through. And it's not so syrupy a beer, but in the barley wine, you want to enjoy the malt. You want to enjoy that big, you know, relatively high finishing gravity. What are we talking about?
Barley wines finish usually in the 20s somewhere, you know, specific gravity of, you know, 1020 to 1029. I think the BJCP gives, let's English ones dip down to 1.018 and I think 1.016 for American styles, but then it goes, in both those cases, it goes all the way up to 1.030. So, you know, the 20s is basically the range you're shooting for there. You know, a little bit lower on the if you're making the smallest possible barley wines.
And what's the alcohol by volume range that we're looking at?
Usually about 8 to 12% by volume.
So big beers.
Yeah. Yeah. Big beers, with you try to make a wort that's moderately fermentable, you know, sort of not highly fermentable like a double IPA, not, you know, lowly fermentable like a beer that would be normal strength but sweet, you know, middle of the road fermentability, but then you rely on the very high starting gravity to ensure that your finishing gravity is fairly high.
So can extract brewers, can you brew a good barley wine using just extracts alone?
Sure. Or, well, if you mean extracts alone without any grains, I don't know that. but I know you can certainly, with a small partial mash, make a great, you know, great barley wine. In fact, one of the big reasons to use a partial mash is to get the aroma of base malt into your extract beer. And the nice thing about a barley wine, extract barley wine, is you don't really need that big of a partial mash because, I mean, malt extract retains some, you know, aroma of malt. Some of it's lost in the condensation process, but not all of it. And so you have a bunch there to work with of malt extract. And then just a small partial mash on top of that can really just sort of add the finishing touch. And yeah, you can make a really good barley wine with extract. And on the website, we actually have an extract version of a barley wine.
Do you have to worry with extract that your finishing gravity might even be even higher than you're looking for?
Some extracts, yeah, have the reputation of not being very fermentable. And you'd want to try to pick an extract that you've worked with that you know has a sort of middle-of-the-road fermentability. Either that or if you know, like if you've brewed with this, you know, one kind of pale extract for a while and you know it always finishes a couple, you know, a couple points higher than you should, you can always cut it a little bit with sugar. I mean, our barley wines are generally all malt beers. Like if you make an all grain version, very few of them have sugar as an adjunct. A few English types do, but it's usually an all malt beer. But if you're using extract that has a low degree of fermentability, you can substitute in a little bit. You know, I'd say about 10% at the max of sugar for extract to help out a bit. But you shouldn't. With most extracts, you shouldn't really need that. They're probably going to be in at least roughly the right range, and it doesn't hurt if a barley wine finishes a couple, you know, ticks high. I mean, you've got the range can go up to 30, so you've got some room to play with there.
And doing a partial mash can also help with your fermentability as well, right?
Sure. Yeah, it can help just because the partial mash wort you make is more fermentable, and you can also blend that wort with the malt extract, and the enzymes from that partial mash wort can go to work on the malt extract as well too.
Yeah,
to chew on it for a little while.
That's one thing that we didn't talk about in the previous barley wine chat. I don't think was the trick of blending your partial mash in with your extract wort, and then letting it sit for a bit and letting those enzymes do some more work on the extract wort.
Right, because you, from what I understand, and I don't know the chemistry of this completely, but part of the reason that extracts can be less fermentable is a little bit of either caramelization or something like caramelization going on during the condensation process when they're evaporating off the water. But part of it is also just whatever mash conditions they set up. And if they were shooting for a middle of the road fermentability, which they probably were, then, you know, you can expose that extract wort to a partial mash wort and the enzymes there in any, carbohydrates that haven't been sort of modified by the enzymes that come from the extract, or the enzymes that come from the partial mash wort, they'll act on the carbohydrates from the extract and modify them and break them down into simple sugars.
So what if you're doing an all-grain beer? How are we going to design that recipe? What's the malt bill going to look like?
Well, that's, to me, one of the fun things about a barley wine is you have a couple ways to proceed with your grain bill and malt production. In terms of what malts you're going to use, it's mostly pale malt and a little bit of crystal malt. Some people, because they're a bigger version of pale ale, some people like scale up both the pale malt and the amount of crystal malt in their recipes to get to a barley wine recipe, and also because of the high finishing gravity. I prefer to keep the amount of crystal malt roughly the same as you would have it in a pale ale, and just scale up pale malt only. And then I there's other specialty malts you can use in little, bits and drabs in a barley wine, but basically a good recipe is just pale malt and a little bit of crystal. Because it's you're going to get the quality of the beer is going to come from picking a good quality base malt, a good crystal malt, and then running a good fermentation. So and then once you've decided the malts to use, you get to decide how you're going to make your wort. And once you have sort of there's two extremes and then an endless amount of different I don't know how to say it.
Approaches.
You have two extremes and an infinite amount of approaches that are midway between the two. The one extreme is that you would figure out how much grain you would need given your usual extract efficiency, mash that, run off all the wort you can out of your, fully sparge your grain bed till you're left with, wort, between 1040 and 1045, but a bunch of it, and then just boil, 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 boil for hours and hours and hours to get that to barley wine strength. The second way to do it is to collect, or the second extreme way to do it is to just load up your mash tun with as much grain as it will handle, collect only the first wort, don't sparge at all, just run off the wort from your mash, and then you boil, much less because your initial, the first wort might be, might be as high as 1080 or maybe even 1085. Because it's completely undiluted yet, and so there's those two extremes, and then there's somewhere in the middle, which is probably what most people take, is that you mash the grains, you run off the first wort, and you sparge for a little while, but you cut it short eventually, that which saves you on boil time, and it also leaves behind there's some sugars in the grain bed, which you can then use to make a second beer if you would want to.
So there's some strategies that you got to look at, and a lot of that may depend on your experience with your own brewing system as far as, figuring out how much you're going to boil away and during a certain amount of time, because you can figure out if you've got a certain amount of water at a certain gravity, you can extrapolate then, how much water you're going to need to boil off to get to the gravity that you need.
Right.
And it's basically simple math. I mean, if you have, for instance, 5 gallons of water or 5 gallons of wort at 1050, five times 50 is 250. And then if you want to figure out what your gravity is going to be at 4 gallons, you just divide 250 by four, right?
Right. Yeah, it's just the what chemistry people would know as the concentration and volume equation. It's like C1V1 equals C2V2, where C is concentration and V is volume. And you just you can solve for either C or V depending on, what you want to do.
So there's a little bit of math involved, but it's not too hard.
Yeah, it's you could handle on a way old school calculator that only had addition, subtraction, multiplication, and division. It's nothing beyond that.
Otherwise known as a phone today.
Yeah.
So once you get your wort, I mean, and one thing that you got to think about is that it's kind of difficult to do a light colored barley wine, isn't it?
You've got so much, essentially, you've got so much pale malt in your. In a barley wine, if you're taking just an all grain barley wine, about the lightest you could do was just take, a ton of pale malt and run off just the first wort, and that would be about the lightest you could make a barley wine. But even there, you would have just due to concentration, it would already be sort of a deep golden. If you've ever made a pale beer from only pale malts, you know that. The first wort runs off. It's not into the amber yet, but it's pretty thick and it's pretty, sort of a deep golden. And then any amount of boiling you do is going to develop more color as you go, due to Maillard reactions. The amount of color you pick up actually is fairly small. I think it's smaller than most people realize, because you get also just the fact that you're condensing the wort makes it darker, not due to the development of any new color, but just you sort of, if you want to think about it, crunching all the old color into a smaller volume. And then, and then of course any crystal malts you add are going to add color. So like for if you're making an all grain beer, even at the with all pale malts, even at the lower end of the range, it's going to be sort of a deep golden. It's not going to be a light color like a Belgian triple can be potentially, or even a double IPA can sometimes be, because there's a lot of sugar typically in the recipe of that. And then from there, I mean, barley wines can range to from all the way through the light ambers to the dark ambers, even into the sort of light browns.
So you can use that knowledge in your recipe formulation. You might not need to add, that little bit of chocolate malt or whatever that you usually use to darken up your pale ale, because there's going to be some darkening with all the boiling and the removal of water already. And a good way to think about it. And you wrote in this article that I didn't really think about it. You talked about the difference between caramelization and the Maillard reaction, and then just the fact that, as you said, there's more stuff in a smaller amount of water, so it's going to be darker. I mean, think about if you had, Kool-Aid, and you made a recipe of grape Kool-Aid with half the water, it would be darker than if you then added the rest of the water. Then it would be lighter. So there's just more stuff that makes color in a smaller amount of volume, so your beer is just going to be darker.
Right. And I actually did a whole one in the series was just on color alone. And one thing I pointed out, you can do a kind of a neat little test to see how much color your boil is developing versus simply concentrating the wort. If you take at the beginning of your boil, take your dipstick and see, or look on your sight glass, depending on how you figure out how much volume you've got in your kettle. See how much volume you've got in your kettle, and for every gallon you have, take an ounce of sample. So, like, let's say you're starting with 8 gallons, and you're going to boil it down. Take an 8 ounce sample, then boil it down to 5 or wherever you're boiling it down to, and again, take a sample based on that same idea. If you have 5 gallons of post-boil wort, take a 5 ounce sample, and then what you do. So those two are sort of equivalent to your pre and post-boil wort, but then dilute the second one to the same volume as the first. In our example, dilute the 5 gallon sample to the 8 gallon size, so the 5 ounce sample to the 8 ounce size, and compare them that way, because that adding the water erases, the influence of just the concentration, just the evaporation of water. But any actual Maillard reactions or any sort of reaction that darkened the wort will show up, and you can compare those two. And I think when most people try it the first time, they'll probably be a little bit shocked at how little color, like, the boil develops directly. Most of the color the boil develops is just due to concentration.
So let's talk about hops. I guess it'd be different depending on what style of or what influences you wanted to take for your barley wine, but we're going to want a pretty solid amount of bitterness to offset all that malt, that malty flavor, right?
Yeah, barley wines are big beers, and given that they finish at a fairly high finishing gravity, they can also tend to be a little bit sweet, and the bitterness is needed to help upset that, because they aren't, or they shouldn't be, like, exceedingly, like, cloyingly sweet. you don't want to taste them and just, be assaulted. Like, it shouldn't be like tasting a Coke or something. It should be more balanced. And so, yeah, you'll need, I don't know, I forget off the top of my head where the BJC puts it, but you need at least about 40 IBUs just to start cutting through some of that. And then depending on the style of beer you're making, the that might be different. American barley wines, you can run up to basically 100 plus IBUs if you want. Bigfoot Sierra Nevada's barley wine has about 90, if I remember, it's in the mid-90s IBUs, and that's sort of a beer that's held up to be almost a type specimen for American barley wine. What's the Anchor beer?
Old Foghorn.
Anchor Old Foghorn likewise is very hoppy, very bitter. And in contrast, some of the English barley wines are on the lower end of are have less hops than that, but they aren't they aren't sweet is a thing. They maybe aren't the complete punch in the face of hops that some of the American versions are, but they certainly aren't sweet by any stretch of the imagination.
And since you're dealing with needing a lot of bitterness, you probably are wise to just choose a high alpha acid hop for your bitterness addition, so that you're not just throwing just a ton of, a big old salad of of hops, and having a lot of vegetable matter in there in your boil.
Hops, when as brewers we think about them adding alpha acids that get isomerized to isoalpha acids in the boil. We think of them adding bitterness to the beer. We think about them adding flavor and aroma via the various hop oils. But they also add, just tannins, because they're plant material, and just plant, quote unquote junk or gunk. And in a barley wine, you're going to be adding a lot of hops anyway. And these are going to, at the end of the boil, they're going to settle down to the bottom of your kettle, and they're going to lower your yield of wort a little bit because you've got to either siphon the wort off the top of them, or you've got to run them through some sort of strainer, including a hop jack or something. But basically, all the plant material you dump in the boiling wort is going to take a little bit of your yield from you. So, and especially in a barley wine where the wort is so thick, I like, minimizing the amount of hops that it takes to reach my goals for bitterness and flavor and aroma. So definitely pick a high alpha bittering hop. Most of the, by the time the long boil is over, and you'll add the bittering hops with, between 90 and 60 minutes left, most of their aroma characteristics are going to be boiled off. So it's not that critical what the flavor of the hop is. Although, I mean, some of the bittering hops can be have strong enough flavors that you might want to pick a more neutral one, but or a blend of different ones. But basically, pick your bittering hop for being a high alpha hop. And then on the flip side of that, I like to, in a barley wine, I like to add almost all of my hops, if not all of my late hops, just right at knockout. Because that way you get the most oils out of them is what you want, because they'll be extracted at that temperature at knockout, but they won't be all boiled off. You could even, I've never tried this, but I suppose you could even start cooling your wort and throw them in like between 180 and 170 degrees Fahrenheit as you're cooling down, and you might even get more out of them because those temperatures would certainly be enough to extract the oils, but there would be less temperature to evaporate them off.
And on
Some people do that in a like an IPA. That's a technique that some people call like a hop stand, is that they sort of add them sort of in a for homebrewers, it's sort of like a pseudo whirlpool.
Mm-hmm. So for the bittering hops, even though you're boiling for an extended period of time past the usual hour, hour and a half, you still add your bittering hops 60, 90 minutes before the end of the boil as you normally would.
Yeah, I've read, although I've actually never tried it, but I've read that if you boil hops past a certain point, you start getting some off flavors from them. And again, that's something I haven't tried or I don't know of, but it seems like, well, for one thing, the amount of alpha acids you get from hops sort of starts peaking at about 60 minutes, and it tails off a little after 90 minutes. So even if you boil them longer, using the normal, or at least looking at the normal curve, what it would predict is that you, beyond 90 minutes, you wouldn't be getting much more alpha acids out of them for the extended boil. And given that, coupled with the fact that I've read that it extended, you know, very extended hop boils lead to off flavors, yeah, I would recommend just adding them in the last hour or hour and a half.
And let's talk about Trub. I mean, you're going to have a lot of, you know, with an all-grain batch especially, you're probably going to have a lot of Trub because you're going to have a lot of grain in there and then a lot of hops and a lot of boil time. And, you know, there's going to be a bunch of stuff down at the bottom of your kettle. What do you do with that? How do you deal with it?
Well, how you deal with it really depends a lot on how your brew kettle is set up. If you have just a regular kettle with a valve coming out the side, that's what I have. One thing that I do is just when I cool down the wort, when it gets down to, you know, maybe I'll cool it maybe 5 degrees Fahrenheit lower than my target, and then I'll just put the cover on it, you know, drape something over the top, and I'll just let it sit for a couple hours. That way all the molecules will just sort of compact, and the Trub will just, the volume of it will just decrease, essentially because the solid material is just settling, sinking lower. And then I'll siphon the wort off the top of it. And if you really want to recover the every last bit of wort, you can then take all your Trub and put it into sanitized mason jars, stick it in the fridge overnight, and you'll come back, and that'll compact by like about half. You'll be able to pour out for every quart of, you know, wort that you put in a mason jar. It'll have about, you know, half of that will be wort that you can pour into your fermenter the next day. Other people, of course, have, you know, in their kettles, they'll have the little hop screens, and so those people just kind of filter out the wort from the Trub. And if you have a hop jack, I mean, that can be a really great thing especially for a barley wine, because you pack it with hops and you get more hop aroma in the beer at the end. And you also have to, of course, need to add correspondingly less to the kettle. So yeah, what you do with the Trub is is dependent on how you're set up. And like I said, the one thing you can do is if you're making your beer and you end up with just a gigantic amount of Trub left over and you're looking at it thinking, you know, there's a lot of wort in there I could get, save it all overnight in a sanitized container, and it'll compact down and you can pour off a decent amount of wort. You know, with a barley wine, it might even be worthwhile to take that, to make that extra effort.
Let's talk about fermentation. Probably, arguably, the most important part of this, because fermentation can be hard with big high gravity beers. So, what yeast strains are we looking at, and how do we prepare them for the wort? How do we prepare the wort for the yeast?
Right. I would definitely agree that fermentation is what makes or breaks a barley wine. I mean, you can screw up during wort production, but even, you know, the worst you could normally screw up is not going to be as damaging to the quality of your beer as running a poor fermentation. And so when you're looking for a yeast strain, you want to look for a couple things. You want to look for one, and this is obvious, that it works, can ferment high alcohol beers. You want to look at the projected ABV of your beer, and then look at the alcohol tolerance of your yeast strain, and make sure that those are pretty close. You can, from what I've seen, you can push yeast, especially if you pitch big, a little bit, maybe a percentage or two above their advertised alcohol tolerance. But basically, you should be smart and pick a yeast that's known to be tolerant of the range, of alcohol that you're shooting for. And then the really big key is pitching an adequate amount of yeast, because even with an alcohol tolerant strain, if you would pitch the same amount of yeast as you would say to a pale ale, the yeast is just going to get bogged down. It's going to take a while for it to start, probably even longer than it would take to start in the pale ale, because it's dealing with a different osmotic pressure. And if you underpitch, your fermentation is much more likely to be sluggish or to stick at a high gravity. And what you really want, especially after putting all that effort into making your barley wine wort, what you really want is just a nice ordered fermentation. You want to pitch enough yeast so that it starts in the appropriate amount of time, hopefully within 8 to 16 hours, would be sort of average and good for a pitched, an adequately pitched barley wine wort. You want the fermentation to proceed smoothly. You don't want it to go for a while, get bogged down, and then sort of pick up again. And then, and you certainly don't want it to stick at an overly high finishing gravity. And, you want the fermentation to basically just to keep going steadily until it, hits your final gravity. And pitching an adequate amount of yeast will definitely do that. If you're making barley wines that are sort of in the lower half of the gravity range, 8 to 10%, simply making an adequately sized yeast starter, it just absolutely will ensure all that happens for you. If you're making barley wines in the upper half, you might have to do a couple little extra things at the end, like rousing your yeast, or for the really biggest ones, you might want to consider doing two shots of aeration, one when you first pitch the yeast, and then a second one, hopefully timed to be, a couple hours before high Kreuzen. But basically, pitching enough yeast is going to be the thing that makes or breaks your barley wine.
And then you mentioned aeration. If you don't use oxygen, this may be an instance where you might want to try it. Or would shaking be enough?
If you're going to, the way I look at it, if you're going to put all the effort, first of all, you're going to spend all the money on the grain and put all the effort into making your barley wine wort, you're going to want to aerate it properly. And shaking is, I don't know, that is, you're probably going to need more air than that. I would get either, get an aeration stone and a HEPA filter, and then use either an aquarium pump to pump air, aerate with just plain air, or get, those little red cylinders of, welding oxygen and aerate with oxygen. Either one of those, a shot of like a minute and a minute and a half of pure oxygen, especially if you swirl the ferment around as you're giving it to it, so it spreads out all the little bubbles, will do great. And, maybe 5 to 10 minutes with the aquarium pump, that'll do. That should be enough for the yeast. And then, like I said, for the biggest ales, maybe a second little shot, maybe, half the duration of your first one right before high Kreuzen would help the absolute biggest barley wines. We'll give that yeast a little bit of, a little bit of extra health going, into the heaviest part of fermentation.
So how do you know I don't so much anymore, but I used to get questions regularly about stuck fermentations. How do you know if your barley wine fermentation is stuck?
Yeah, that's a good question, because for a lot of people, especially if they normally make sort of lower gravity beers or average gravity beers, the barley wine they know is going to stop at a higher final gravity. But if you don't have any experience, and your fermentation stay stops at 1028, you don't know, is that done or is it stuck or what? And one thing that can really help you when you're making a barley wine is to do a forced fermentation test. And this is basically just take a small sample of wort, only a couple ounces. Take the sample generally. It's best to do it right after you aerate, but before you pitch your yeast. Take that sample and then completely over pitch it with your yeast. Like if you take an 8-ounce sample, add a teaspoon of yeast slurry to it, which comparatively would be just incredibly over pitching, and then store that wort warm, up to 80 degrees or something, because you're not making beer with it. You're just seeing how to what degree the yeast are going to attenuate that. So, and for a home brewer, one thing is you don't want to waste a ton of beer on your forced fermentation test, but you also want to be able to have it be worthwhile. So one thing is take enough sample that you can float a hydrometer in it, because that's what the hydrometers is what you're going to be used to measure the gravity. So, take usually 250 milliliters is going to be, easily enough. And that's not, such a huge loss to your batch size. So take a 250 mil roughly sample of that, over pitch it with yeast, store it warm, and then check the final gravity that reaches. And that'll tell you ahead of time, because that'll be done in 3 or 4, maybe 5 days, given that it's a higher gravity thing. That'll tell you what your beer will ferment at, and then your main batch, which will be fermenting at a lower temperature somewhere and taking longer, you'll know that when it stops, take a hydrometer sample, and if it's, at the same or, within a point or two of your forced fermentation sample, it's done. But if it's way higher than that, your fermentation is stuck, and at that point maybe raise the temperature and rouse the yeast.
So once you get down to reach your final gravity, you get down to where you need to be, you talk about conditioning, and you recommend taking a bit more care than in standard ales in conditioning the beer.
Yeah, the big thing is because you're probably going to be aging it longer, just make some extra effort to keep oxygen away from the beer. And if possible, you'll at the end of fermentation, you'll have a big layer of yeast and stuff at the bottom of your beer. Let that all settle out. Give it, maybe a week or two after primary has finished, and then rack that over to a carboy that basically you're going to fill almost completely up. Don't leave a lot of headspace. And you can even if you're super paranoid, give the carboy a squirt of carbon dioxide to start out with, so that you're displacing carbon dioxide with beer as you ferment it or as you siphon it into there. And yeah, just try to keep keep oxygen away from the beer. Rack as quietly as possible. Rack to a carboy that the volume of beer is going to fill it completely. Also, keep an eye on if you're in a house with air conditioning or somewhere where it's really dry, keep an eye on the liquid inside the airlock, because that can evaporate over time. I've had that happen to beers where I just either didn't have time to bottle them or package them or was actually purposely aging them for a while, and then I've gone in there and there's almost no liquid left in the airlock. So check on it frequently. And that's really just keeping oxygen away from your conditioning beer is a big thing. Secondarily, if you can cool it down to, lower than your fermentation temperature, that's going to be great. You know, if you can actually cold condition it, like, you know, as if it were a lager, that'll be good too. And then the big key really is the time it takes to condition a barley wine really depends on how much yeast you pitched. If you pitched enough yeast and you went through a nice ordered fermentation that finished in a reasonable amount of time, the yeast are going to have cleaned up most everything they need to clean up or to have cleaned up by the end of fermentation or, you know, slightly thereafter when the beer, you know, sits on the yeast and you're waiting for it to settle. If the fermentation has really struggled, your conditioning time is going to be longer and longer just because the yeast are, you know, have left more that they need to clean up and they're in worse shape to do it. So one thing, you know, not only pitching an adequate amount of yeast not only helps you with fermentation, it also helps you with conditioning. And especially with a barley wine that you've added a lot of aroma hops to, whereas you want to age it to let the flavors mellow out and all that, which takes a little bit longer on a big beer. You also don't want to age it so long that the hop aroma comes and goes, because mm-hmm. In big beers, hop aroma is sort of one of the first things that starts, that you start to notice takes a hit with aging. So pitching an adequate amount of yeast is really going to help you there, because you should be able, you should be able to be drinking your beer within a couple months if you pitched an adequate amount of yeast. You know, you read a lot of homebrew sources where they say, age it for at least 6 months and blah, blah, blah. And that may be needed if you've underpitched, but if you've pitched an adequate amount of yeast, and also aerated well and conducted your fermentation well, and let the beer sit on the yeast for, you know, a little bit after primary, those really extended conditioning times shouldn't be necessary, you know, especially for the smaller ABV barley wines. For the higher ones, maybe, because then you're, you know, everything is just, there's just more of it. It just takes longer.
And I guess I don't think you addressed this in the articles, but if you're bottling this and doing bottle conditioning, it might not be a bad idea, especially if you've conditioned for a long period of time, to add some fresh yeast, maybe a half a packet of dry yeast or something, and into the bottling bucket when you're bottling the beer, to make sure that you've got enough fresh, healthy yeast in there to eat the sugar that you're priming the bottles with.
Sure. Yeah. If you've got a barley wine that you've brewed it, racked it to secondary, let it condition for, you know, a few months, and then you rack it to your bottling bucket and expect those last few yeast cells to respond quickly to the sugar in the bottling bucket, that's a tough, you know, that's tough for them to do, because they're they've gone through a heavy fermentation and they're not in really great shape, and also the extended time, you know, most of them have settled out. So a little bit of bottling yeast is a good thing. And the big thing to think about when you add bottling yeast is you don't need to add the same strain as your primary fermentation strain, but you don't want to add a yeast that's a better attenuator. Mm-hmm. You know, if you added, let's say you fermented with a yeast that, you know, gave 75% apparent attenuation, and it finished it, conditioned it. If you added bottling yeast that, you know, typically went to 80% apparent attenuation, okay, they're going to eat the glucose in the bottling sugar first, but then there's going to be things in the wort that they can go after that the other yeast couldn't, and they're going to keep fermenting, and you're going to get a gradually more and more carbonated barley wine. So you'd be looking at gushers, mm-hmm. at a minimum, if not broken bottles.
And angry spouses.
Yeah.
Well, very good. Like I say, it's an extensive series of articles. Big topic big series for big beers. So very nice work. And, you know, here's to a good 2014 with the Beer and Wine Journal. I'm sure there's going to be lots of good stuff ahead.
No. we got rid of it all in 2013. It's all downhill from here.
Well, there you go. Bearing the lead at the end of the...
we've got good stuff planning. And hopefully we'll have more... like a lot of what we've had so far in 2013 has been print stuff, which I like. But hopefully we'll have more videos and stuff like that. I'm planning to brew a lot more in 2014 than I did in 2013. And just get out there with my camera and make some little movies about different techniques and stuff. And also just, continue to go through, there's a ton of different cool brewing stuff out there. And we hope to bring it to the attention of homebrewers next year.
Awesome. Thanks, Chris.
Okay. Thanks, James.
Well, thanks again to Chris. If you haven't seen the series of articles, there are a lot more tips in them than we covered here in more detail, along with recipes for both all-grain and extract barley wines. Go to beerandwinejournal.com and check them out, along with a ton of other great articles that Chris has been working on, and a couple three from me. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Our Basic Brewing growler bags are available on our shop. Protect your precious homebrew and craft beer as you take it from place to place. Check out our support link to where you can throw a couple of bucks into the tip jar by subscribing financially to our podcast. We appreciate everybody who's done so over the past year. Be sure to check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. You can find them all on our site. We've got combo deals to save you a few bucks if you want to buy more than one DVD at a time. You can check out our Basic Brewing shirts in the store as well. Our Brewer's Logbooks are on the store, too. Get one for your brand new year. Keep track of up to 50 batches of beer. You can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com. If there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order them online in our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We greatly appreciate the support. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are a Bad Kitty Christmas and Pet Safe Wireless Pet Containment System. Maybe that will contain Bad Kitty. Thanks again, everybody. And remember, I can't tell who bought Watson. No worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping. We greatly appreciate your support. Don't forget, you can also join the American Homebrewers Association and subscribe to Brew Your Own Magazine through the associate links on basicbrewing.com. That's all until next time. Until then, Happy New Year, everybody. Thanks for listening. I'm James Spencer, production help for Basic Brewing Radio, and our website is provided by our buddy Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. Talk to you next time, everybody. So long.